Hi, everyone. Welcome to the INSS English podcast series, where you can listen to researchers discuss their findings and hear about research in progress. I'm Adi Kantor. I'm a research associate in the INSS, and I am joined here today by Ambassador Dan Shapiro, distinguished visiting fellow in the INSS, who served as the American ambassador to Israel from 2011 to 2017. Good morning, Dan. Hello.
Good to be with you.
So we will discuss today an alarming subject, disturbing subject, and this is the rising anti-Semitism, both in Europe, in European parliaments, and in the U.S., and we will see if there is any points of comparison between the two regions and where do they differ. So anti-Semitism has returned to the mainstream of political and social discourses, both in the European Parliament and in the United States. It is not a new phenomenon. Anti-Semitism has always been part of the cultural code of both classic and modern societies. Nevertheless, it has today new representations and characteristics that have direct influence on the state of Israel, its national security, as well as on Jewish communities all over the world. I would start with the first question, which I find interesting. What has changed? Why? I mean, anti-Semitism has always been there, right? We have become accustomed to it, unfortunately. It's always been there. It will always be there. And yet we do have a sense, we sense that something has changed. And my question to you, Dan, is what do you think has changed?
So you're correct, and you alluded to it in your introduction, that anti-Semitism has always been there. It's sometimes known as the oldest hatred. We've seen almost no period of history in the West, Western civilization, and other parts of the world too, where it hasn't been manifested in some way. Now, After the Holocaust, the extreme devastation that manifestation caused in some ways made it possible for those elements of society that wanted to fully delegitimize those views to push it far underground. That coincided with the rise of the State of Israel at a time when there was considerable sympathy and maybe even rooting for the fledgling, then fledgling state struggling to survive. But of course, over the years, a couple of things have happened. In recent years, I think we are emerging into a period of some economic dislocation, technological dislocation, immigration flows. These are often the kinds of disruptions in societies which enables hatreds that have been suppressed, that have been deemed out of bounds, to find their way back into the discourse as people who are feeling left behind or otherwise dislocated by these very rapid and disruptive changes in society look for a scapegoat, look for someone to blame. And so those threads are there, but now they're sort of emerging back out into the open. And then you could add to that an element of anti-Israel sentiment. Some of it's related to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Some of it is related to a much deeper kind of delegitimization of Israel's even right to exist. And those threads are there present as well in a way that when Israel now does not appear so much to people as the underdog, they find expression in a kind of hatred of Israel, which is a new expression of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I fully agree. And I ask myself, you know, while you speak, is, anti-Semitism has definitely a lot to do also with anti-Israel, anti-Zionism. We should say anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism, although it has been difficult to transfer this message. What do you think about the tension between anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism? Why is it hard for Jews, for Israelis to convince people around the world that it is actually the same?
Sometimes it gets caught up in the headlines of the moment, whether there are negotiations underway, if there's violence, if there's a war in Gaza, if there's terrorist attacks, with the issue of settlement expansion. And so the blurring of the lines between what can be a legitimate criticism of Israeli policy, while not delegitimizing Israel's existence, and those who for whom no Israeli policy is really acceptable and is always suspect because it comes under the headline of Zionism, of a Jewish state, when that idea seemed delegitimized. I think the blurring of those lines has made it at times difficult. For example, in the BDS movement, which we see prominent on some college campuses in the United States, there are certainly activists who support its core ideology, which really does delegitimize Israel's existence. That's a form of anti-Semitism. That doesn't mean every single person who at times, out of frustration because of some policy they've seen and some desire to promote movement on Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and has been drawn toward what pressure tactics could be used is necessarily motivated by anti-Semitism. But those lines are sometimes very blurry.
Is it? I fully agree. Do you think it's a matter of left and right? I mean, anti-Semitism seems to be crossing these, you know, only left and right definitions. And we see definitely in the U.S., we will also come to more to examples what is happening today in Europe and what is happening in the U.S. But I have a feeling that anti-Semitism is maybe a bit above all this. It's not a right-wing thing. It's not a left, merely a right-wing thing or a left-wing or radical left-wing issue. It seems to cross all parties. And I'm thinking with myself, how can Jewish communities deal with this notion, with understanding that it's actually, is it a merely political question, or are we dealing here with a lot more than just a political thing? It's has a lot to do with culture, with psychology as well. Maybe anti-Semitism, not maybe, I mean, researchers have said it before, that anti-Semitism has a lot to do also with mental, it's in a way a mental illness that the world has not yet, humanity has not yet fully captured. So it's not just politics.
There's no question. It finds expression in political discourse, but it is coming out of something deeper culturally. And clearly it manifests itself, at least in the American context, I think it's probably true in Europe, you'll know better than I, with both a left and a right version. And so you can have a person like David Duke, former leader of the Ku Klux Klan, considered, if the definition fits, on the far right end of the spectrum in the United States politics, extreme right, expressing open hostility to Jews and open hostility to Israel. And then you can have someone like Louis Farrakhan, coming out of a very what is considered strong left-wing, extreme left-wing version within the African-American community, giving expression to almost the identical hatreds. In fact, the two of them at times will reinforce each other in their...
It's like the two poles somehow
meet on the other and the other
Where
side.
Where do they meet? Where do you think they meet?
I guess it, again, that sort of deep sense of grievance and looking for a scapegoat, someone to vilify, to explain those aspects of the society, culture, the economy that they feel are unjustified. So
grows out of fear.
Out of fear. So the extreme right version might say culture is changing. There's waves of immigrants. The United States is becoming more diverse.
Yes.
We have these fights over the wall, over immigration flows. And so the idea of the United States as a white Christian nation, if that's something that is held dear, is threatened by these changes. And of course, Jewish presence itself and Jewish activism on behalf of those multicultural trends, which has often been present, can irritate.
And Jews are often related to, you know, Jewish organizations helping migrants in the
absolutely.
U.S. and therefore are hated because of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then on the far left, if you say, you know, there's a dislocation and economic deprivation and inequality, and it affects certain minority communities more than others, and maybe there's a certain identification then with the Palestinians as the underdog in that
as
conflict.
The victims.
As the victims. Again, looking for the scapegoats, looking for someone to vilify. And those deep cultural sources then spring to the surface.
Do you think that anti-Israel, and that's, I ask myself the same question, is anti-Semitism a Jewish problem? Is something that Jews have to deal with? Is it something that Israel should deal with in particular? Is it, because I can tell you from the European context, many Europeans today say that it's actually anti-Semitism has nothing to do with Jews. Jews shouldn't, it's not their problem. It's a European problem that we as the EU or we as European citizens have to deal with. And it has actually nothing to do with Jews. Jews or State of Israel sometimes take it to themselves. We have to fight against it. Is it our problem?
Well, it's our problem in the sense that it is directed at us. And I think one of the great lessons of Zionist history and Israeli history is that at some point you have to stand up and defend yourself. You can't depend on others, and you can't necessarily depend on broader society, can't necessarily, in Israel's case, depend on the international community to stand up and defend you. And so it's a Jewish problem in the sense that Jews need to be prepared to fight against those phenomena. It doesn't necessarily mean physical fighting of it, but certainly using legal means, certainly means building alliances with those in the society, hopefully who do recognize that their responsibility is just as is really the what is needs to be addressed. In the United States, I would say I speak broadly about the Jewish community. Certainly, you have organizations that are specifically devoted to defending Jews and defending other minorities against discrimination and these types of hatreds. But there is a strong expectation, and most of the time met, that we will have many, many allies across a wide spectrum of American society who will also declare these types of expressions and certainly the threats that they sometimes lead to as completely unacceptable, completely out of bounds. But if we don't stand up for ourselves and demand that of others, we might find that they won't do it on their own.
Okay. I would like now to, in the few minutes that we have left, to talk more on on the regional aspect. Talk about Europe and afterwards more deeply on about the United States and see where are the differences, where's the common denominator that goes there. I can tell you now, when discussing Europe, first of all, we cannot see Europe as a whole today. There's a lot of tension between member states within the EU. There's Eastern member states, and there's Western member states, and there's North and there's South, and the representations of anti-Semitism, they differ from state to state. When you look, for example, at Hungary today, and when you look at Poland or the Visegrad countries, we see this phenomenon is rising very, very fast, and it's in the parliament themselves. I mean, it's there. They're not in the opposition parties. It's the leaders of Hungary today. It's the leaders of Poland. Hungary, of course, represented by Viktor Orban and his anti-Soros campaign during the elections. There's a tendency of the Eastern European countries, and we really definitely see it in the East, for rising, I would say, patriotism, a return to nationalism, and with it, of course, to going, towards the right wing, radical right wing path. And this, of course, includes within it also racism and anti-Semitism. And this is something that we see all over Europe, but especially in the East.
Some of those same governments then will declare themselves to be strong supporters of Israel. How does that sit with the Jewish communities who are experiencing that they have these governments giving voice to strong nationalist attitudes and even openly anti-Semitic attitudes? While declaring themselves to be good friends.
The best friends of Israel.
Yeah. How does that sit with those Jewish communities?
It doesn't. My answer is that it doesn't. And this is not only a problem of the Jewish communities, it's also a problem of us Israelis and the Israeli policy. And how do we see our relations with those communities? Because they actually expect something of us. And I think this is exactly where we can compare also to the Jewish communities in the United States. They expect Israel to help and to assist and to protect when they feel threat or fear, and they definitely, and it's, their fear is very justified. To be today a Jew in Budapest is a lot harder than it used to be 10 years or 20 years ago. Warsaw is going in this direction, the Czech Republic is going in this direction. This anti-Semitism, it's also, there are more Catholic states. It has a lot to do also with religion here. Jews today, there are not so many, by the way, unfortunately, after the Holocaust. We don't talk about massive numbers, but there are Jews who live there, and many of them don't even show any Jewish symbols when they go outside the house, because they don't know what will happen if a right-wing or a neo-Nazi will meet them in the street. And this is really, it really is a problem today.
And then in Western Europe, it looks very different. In Britain, for example, one hears that Jewish communities are feeling a rise of anti-Semitism from the left. And of course, it's sometimes associated with Jeremy Corbyn. And some would say in those and other Western European countries, the rise of Muslim populations are part of this. How does it manifest itself differently in Western Europe?
Anti-Semitism is anti-Semitism. You know, this is what I return now to what I said before, that it's actually not a matter of right wing or left wing, or when it comes from the radical Islam groups or radical. Actually, when it comes to anti-Semitism, there is a common denominator that goes through all the parties and all religions. And the ones suffering from this are the Jews in the end. Yes, we see it, by the way, yesterday, Theresa May lost in the parliament. And we see there is a real chance now for Jeremy Corbyn to become the leader after May. And this is really, it really is a problem that needs to be attended. And this is a guy who's the leader of the Labour Party. Left wing, he's considered a radical left wing leader, who has not only a problem with, he says that he has a problem with Israel, but we know that his anti-Zionist and anti-Israeli, I would say, arguments cover, it's only a layer that covers a lot deeper, I would say, anti-Semitic notes. And this could be the next leader of the UK. This is an alarming problem.
To the point where many British Jews who have long been associated with the Labour Party
are not there anymore. Exactly. They have left the party, and with really good reasons. They don't feel represented anymore by their own party. It's actually, it's history in a way laughs back, because the Labour Party historically used to be the best, I would say, the party that would represent Jews in the best way. And today, Jews in the UK don't feel represented there. So I think it's tragic. It is tragedy. And going back now to the US, I think when we look at the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, anti-Semitism exists in both parties. How can Jews deal with this there when they know that it doesn't matter where they go, doesn't matter, the party doesn't represent them in the end?
Yeah, I think it's not reached that level of extreme penetration in either party in the United States, thankfully. But it does appear to be creeping in from the margins toward the center. Still far more unacceptable broadly in American society than I think you would find in either the Eastern or Western European model. But those voices are there. And obviously, it's very important that political leaders step up and define it as unacceptable in their own camp. We just had a case this week where a member of Congress, Steve King of Iowa, Republican member of Congress, made comments where he seemed to defend the idea of white supremacism. These are not actually new comments for him, but for whatever reason, they touched the nerve, and he has now been widely condemned by members of his own party, which is a healthy step, probably overdue. There certainly are extreme attitudes among some within what would one call the progressive coalition. And you've seen this in the leadership of the women's marches, some of whom have been close to Farrakhan, some of whom have expressed deeply anti-Zionist attitudes, some of whom have demanded that Jewish organizations who want to participate condemn Israel or adopt certain positions in order to be welcome. That also needs to be called out. And I say where the Democratic Party has now said they will not participate in these national marches until there's some change of leadership. So those are very important steps that the leaderships of those parties need to take to keep those attitudes firmly at the margins and in the category of unacceptable, and not allow them to gradually creep in toward the center.
fully agree. What should be, what do you think, in your view, should be the Israeli policy towards anti-Semitism in the U.S. now under Trump? Trump, and you, I think you would agree with me, has not always condemned as much as he could. I mean, he didn't condemn anti-Semitic representations and manifestations, and he definitely allows... I don't know if he knows or doesn't know. This is a different question, or how much is he aware of what he's doing. But he, the fact is that he doesn't condemn. He doesn't seem to prevent these events from occurring. So how, what can be done when we talk about now from the Israeli context, sure. from the policy of the state of Israel towards this, and the 5 minutes that we have left. How can this issue be dealt under Trump in the American context? And I will maybe conclude with regards to Europe and the Visegrad countries.
So first, it's important to say I don't believe Donald Trump is an anti-Semite. I would not make such a claim. I do believe, either out of ignorance or out of some political opportunism, he has avoided proper condemnation of anti-Semitic expressions and some other prejudice and racial expressions, racist expressions. And I believe it is because he understands that some of the people who do hold those views are within the camp of people who support him, and he doesn't want to alienate them. And so he either avoids condemning them or even at times sends signals, what are sometimes called dog whistles, to indicate, or at least this is what they're hearing. So the effect that has when he fails to properly condemn people marching in Charlottesville, mm-hmm. Holding Ku Klux Klan torches and saying Jews will not replace us. Okay. When he claimed ignorance of Stephen King's very unacceptable remarks. When he doesn't recognize that the attitudes he was expressing about immigration were echoed by the shooter at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. Then. I believe that gives oxygen and it allows people who fuel and allows people who previously felt that their attitudes were completely unacceptable and they held them, but they had to hide under the rocks to feel that it's okay to raise their heads and it's okay to raise their voices and that there is some legitimization, intentionally or otherwise, being signaled to them by the national leadership. That's really something that has to be called out and needs to be done differently. Now, Israel, of course, has a responsibility. I believe anywhere Jews are subject to anti-Semitism, Israel defines itself as the nation state of the Jewish people.
Home of the Jewish people.
Home of the Jewish people has historically stood up for oppressed communities or brought them to Israel if they were in grave distress. And so that should be applicable in a United States context as well. The challenge here is that the Israeli government and many Israeli citizens see Donald Trump as a friendly president. They appreciate things he has done for Israel.
As the best thing that ever happened to Israel.
He's moved the embassy to Jerusalem. He has withdrawn from the Iran nuclear deal. He's provided strong support at the UN. And so there's appreciation for those things. I think the challenge for Israel is to find a way to walk and chew gum, as we say in English, to at the same time, to on the one hand express appreciation for those policies that it deems supportive, and of course to try to maintain the best possible relationship with the president, one who's quite mercurial and doesn't like to be criticized, yes. while at the same time being sensitive to the vulnerabilities that many Americans, Jewish and non-Jewish, are feeling because of the way the discourse that he conducts seems to give oxygen and fuel to these extreme and even anti-Semitic elements. And I'm not sure that balance is in place. After the shootings in Pittsburgh, several senior Israeli officials came ostensibly to comfort the community, which is, of course, an appropriate thing to do, and found themselves giving interview after interview where they were defending Donald Trump as if nothing he said and none of his discourse had any connection to the same attitudes that were expressed by
as if he's disconnected from the whole event.
And I think that landed very uncomfortably with many American Jews, that here was Israel not showing sufficient sensitivity to those vulnerabilities and not being a sufficient voice in support. There was a lot of attention in those same comments about anti-Semitism from the left, which is a real issue and needs to be addressed. Yeah. But the shooter in Pittsburgh was not one of those. He was an anti-Semite.
He was
the
right-wing radical.
And so that violent version, which for the first time really in most American Jews' lives, brought to life the idea that they would need the same kind of protection in American synagogues that we've traditionally seen in European synagogues, which is shocking for the first time many Americans go to Europe, is something that shouldn't have been forgotten while rushing to defend Trump and turning the attention toward the left-wing version of anti-Semitism, much as it needs to be addressed.
I would add to that, and with this we will also finish our fascinating discussion, the problem of short memory. You discussed, you just mentioned that we forgot. Israel, I would say many also politicians in Israel have a problem of short memory also in the context of, in the European context. Now we talk about how to address Trump and his policy, what to do with right-wing populist parties in Europe who seek this connection to Israel, to Israeli parties, right-wing parties, to find that this is the best alibi, to have the Jewish state, the Israel, as your best friend, so-called, of course, this is, of course, only a cover, allows these parties in Europe, and I'm talking about Fidesz, I'm talking about the Freedom Party, Austrian Party, for example, who today sit already in the coalitions in Austria, allows them to be more accepted. Once you are a friend, with quotation marks, of course, you're a friend of the Israeli state, of the state of the Jews, then no one can criticize you. But at the same time, these people are definitely hold racist views against whoever is not them, against everybody who's, for example, foreigners, for example, migrants, refugees, these are anti-Semites, and I have a feeling, and it's not only me who says that, there are many, many researchers who definitely have this feeling that many people in Israel have not yet fully captured or understood the danger in having relations with these parties and seeking relations with these parties or with leaders today, like Orbán, for example. We don't only betray the Jewish communities in Europe, I think we betray ourselves and our identity as a Jewish state.
That's a balance that, of course, any Israeli government has to figure out how to strike. How do you work with whoever is on the international scene, because you have to and they're there. But who do you identify with? Who's your friend? And what values are you projecting? And of course, every government will have to make that judgment. But I think that's a significant challenge for the Israeli government, both the American and the European context these days.
Dan, I want to thank you very, very much for this discussion. This concludes our podcast conversation for today. You're welcome to listen to all our podcasts by going to the INSS website at www.inss.org.il, where you'll find a featured section for our podcasts. You're also invited to sign up for our newsletter and receive alerts for the Institute's various research programs. Thank you very much for listening, and take care.